a very nice village, but it's a bit scattered. It's a bit scattered. Awfully scattered. The scattered community.
Well, hello, everyone. And just like certain mid-century Italian, I make the trains run on time. hello. Welcome to the deepest lore. I'm here. And I'm welcoming back Time Stealer. How are you doing, Time Stealer?
Not too bad. I must warn you, like I said to Alex, I've not done much research because I was going to yesterday, but I went fishing instead. My timeline's full of Macedonians going absolutely mental. And I'm doing all right, really. Yeah, I'm doing okay.
And also, a chap who I'm told is pretty high up in the great train of being, Alex Masters. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. No, it's an honour and a privilege to be here, to be called to the bench of Deepest Lore.
Now, you mentioned not doing any research, Time Stealer. I have been trying to record Foundations of Rhetoric this week. I am knee-deep in talking about dark techniques, dark and subliminal persuasion techniques. And so I have not done any research whatsoever. So I'm going to have to play the role of a kind of Alan Partridge-like radio host here.
Oh!
And just ask you two about trains. So you wanted to talk, I mean, I've called the stream British Railway History, but as I put that title in, I then started to get kind of, I started to think, hold on a second, have I made a massive faux pas? Is the history of rail inextricably bound up with America in some way? And how much crossover is there between the American railway and the British railway? So maybe I'll ask you that question first and see where it takes us.
Well, I suggested originally looking at the history of the railways of Britain, because when you... Well, I didn't realise this when I read about it originally when I was younger, but having now watched your channel and looked at our sort of side of things, both economically and socially speaking, understanding the history of railways in this country actually reinforces and helps support a lot of the things we talk about in our circles, because it does reflect them a great many times, economic, but the odd social one as well. And so that's why I suggested the stream originally. There might have been some confusion because after 1948, the railways were nationalised and they were called British Railways. And so there was someone who wondered if we were just talking about that. But no, we're talking about from the beginning to, well, hopefully we won't run out of time and we'll get on to more recent stuff. But yeah, we might have to do part two. It depends.
As much as I'm sure we'd love to do a stream about how the Transport Act 1947 was the worst thing that ever happened to the railways. We'll try and keep it broad. In response to the how much crossover there is, fortunately, there's almost none. Back in the very, very early days, we sent a couple of engines over there from Robert Stevenson Company, sort of 1829, 30, and every single one of them was a failure. They were either too big or too heavy for the Americans, so they decided they were going to build their own. And in response, when they invented air braking in the 1870s, we sacked it off. So there was almost a point of pride that we didn't really import anything American.
Great. Okay, so we can safely talk about British railway history without upsetting any Yankee doodles. Okay, so
step over, Yank.
So. When I think, I mean, to my lay understanding, I know virtually nothing about trains, okay? And my kind of potted schoolboy history, I remember, I think on the back of the £5 note, was George Stevenson and his rocket at one point. Is that the first steam train, the Stevenson rocket?
No.
Are we about to have a massive barnstorm about how you define a train? No. Rocket is famous as a racehorse, essentially. It was built to compete and win the Rainhill Trials. We can get onto how fair the Rainhill Trials were a bit later. But railways have been around for 20 years by then. They're actually invented to win a bet, if you've heard about this time stealer. In 1804, Samuel Homfrey runs an iron founders in South Wales, has a bet with one of his mates, £500, I think it is, actually, which is an enormous amount of money, that there's a chap working for him called Richard Trevithick, and he's proposed building a locomotive engine, as they called it, that could pull 10 tons of iron ore down his little plateway in South Wales, because plateways by then were fairly common. It's just the easiest way. If you lay little strips of iron on the cart tracks, it becomes much easier to pull loads of stuff.
Yes, we're talking about horse-drawn haulage here, which, yeah, like Alex said, it existed long before the steam locomotives, and all the steam locomotives did just made it more efficient, essentially. Originally, they just all they did was put the steam locomotives on the same rails they'd used to carry coal or using horse, essentially a glorified horse and cart. And like Alex said, Trevithick came along, who was Cornish, by the way. So he was a BAME. He was a minority ethnic individual, being from Cornwall, being a Cornishman. So a bit of diversity there.
Not allowed to use that term anymore.
We're not allowed to use that term. Are we going to get yeeted?
No, that spent the last 18 hours being offensive. He's a really fascinating character. He's always known as Captain Dick, and he's 6'4", I think, 6'4", 6'2", which for 1800 is quite a giant. His party trick was to throw sledgehammers over mine shafts, over the winding houses. And, you know, they're about 50, 60 feet high. And apparently he got in a dispute with James Watt and Company over using high-pressure steam, and a bailiff came down to extract royalties, so he hanged him upside down over a mine shaft, which is the correct thing to do with bailiffs, to be honest.
My understanding, again, I pick up bits of history from here and there, you know, little bit from a Sid Meier game here, little bit from a... I'm an avid board gamer, as some people know, and I have a game called Brass, right? It's a board game set in the north of England, at the dawn of the industrial... in the dawn of the industrial revolution, okay? And... you start the game with canals, okay, and you kind of build up factories and things, but then you flip. Basically, there's a moment in the game where it flips to a second phase, and that's when you can start building railways, and it's a massive acceleration in terms of the profitability of all of the kind of enterprises you have going in this board game. And from that, I deduce that the steam train, maybe it wasn't the catalyst for the Industrial Revolution. Obviously, you'd have to say it was the spinning jennies and the, you know, the automated processes in manufacturing. But when the steam trains do come in, when the railway network gets going, it massively accelerates what was already, you know, let's say the Industrial Revolution was just about getting going. You know, if you excuse the pun, they put a rocket launcher on it. Basically, is that true? That's just my kind of lay understanding.
The way I like to explain it to people is that the stationary steam engine, which was invented by James Watt, that was what kickstarted the first Industrial Revolution. And then I consider the development of the steam locomotive to be what kickstarted a second Industrial Revolution, essentially. I always split it in two. I consider them to be two separate entities almost, because it really did just, you know, line go up after you invent steam locomotive, because you could just do everything so much quicker and move goods in larger quantities at high speed. And that's always, you know, obviously going to...
It also, of course, creates massive demand for coal.
Yes.
Another massive part of the Industrial Revolution is the expansion of the coal industry. But let's stay with the early part of it. So we're still in 1804 in my mind, or 1805. at what point does rail really take off and start exploding? Like, when do we get the massive expansion of the railway network?
The actual explosion itself happens really between the Rainhill trials in 1829 and the railway mania and the crash of 1847. That's when the process of actually building, to be honest, most of today's main lines were built in that sort of 10 or 15 years. There is the thing called the railway mania between 1845-46, which is a massive speculative bubble, much like the 20s or even the dot-com bubble, not even helped by the fact that every single railway had to go be enabled by an act of parliament because they had their hands in the trough as well. But it was really that... The Liverpool and Manchester is so successful in its first couple of years that it's regularly paying 10%, 12%, 13% dividends on the investments. And people are suddenly going, I'd like a piece of that action, please.
Yeah, no, and correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, again, I don't know why there's this crossover. I've played a lot of board games and there are an awful lot of 19th century railway themed board games that I've played. Okay,
there may be something of an intersection.
Yeah, there could be an intersection between board game nerds and train nerds, right?
A lot of people over indexing in autism who enjoy both of those things. So, yeah.
But a lot of these games I've played have a very notable, whether they're set in America or whether they're set in Britain, have a very notable stocks and shares component whereby you back certain companies, and it's really the railway expansion in some ways is driven by the you know, investors in the city, you know, genuine capitalistic speculation, if you want to put it that way. I think the popular imagination likes to think of the railway barons, you know, in America, just one enterprising individual, but in truth, a lot of these companies were driven by stocks and shares. Is that right?
It was almost entirely driven by stocks and shares. A lot of the original shareholders, a lot of the first shareholders in lines like the Liverpool and Manchester were shareholders in the canals. They were owners of the canals, and they used the wealth they'd acquired from the canal system, which was also a private enterprise, to, you know, maintain their wealth, and they saw this upcoming technology and they just invested in that instead rather than trying to flog a dead horse, which they realized the canals kind of had already become.
And if they couldn't be persuaded, they could easily be bought off. Actually, the Liverpool and Manchester, I was reading about it in my book. There's an amazing, it's a sort of microcosm of history just post the Napoleonic War, because it makes you appreciate just how much power the aristocracy has. Because there's two lords who own land on the route. There's Lord Derby and Lord Sefton, who sit in the House of Lords.
I like this story.
Who utterly refuse to let the line go through their land. If George Stephenson tries to survey it, admittedly he didn't ask permission first, but shots were fired at him and his team to stop trespassing. And he just got his mates around him in the Lords, and they just went, no, piss off, go away. It wasn't helped by the fact that George did a phenomenally terrible job of the first survey. So when they came in and went, you got a bridge there, and it's going to be underwater at high tide, idiot. That didn't really help. But the other ones were the canals, because there's canals like the Trans-Pennine and the Bridgewater Canal, which is the first canal, actually, modern canal dug in the country. The chap who owned that, the Duke of Bridgewater, George Huskisson, who's the MP for Liverpool and a close personal friend of his, basically goes to dinner with him and says, I will buy you 1,000 shares in the Liverpool and Manchester if you let it go ahead. And by the way, we've written into the Act that it guarantees you a 10% dividend.
Wow. And did he agree to that?
Yeah. Oh, got them eating out the palm of his hand. So it sailed through on the second go.
No. One of the interesting things that brings up, though, the initial resistance of, you know, certain large landowning aristocracy, is that I mean, I think today in, you know, in 2021, appreciation of the railways tends to be quite a conservative thing. You know, we think of Michael Choo Choo Portillo with his endless train documentaries. But also there's various other kind of train enthusiasts, like Peter Hitchens, for example. You know, in a strange way, decries, you know, he always talks about the beaching cuts as a terrible thing and that the railways were a, you know, bedrock of the nation and all this sort of stuff. But then I can imagine a certain other, like an older type of reactionary, decrying the railways as a symbol of industrialism. So how do we navigate? How do we navigate that? And how is it? Do you have any idea of how it played into the politics of this era of the, you know, the early 19th century? Would there have been conservative forces trying to stop the railways? Or
Oh yeah. There was conservative forces, and there was also a lot of religious forces. There were people who considered them to be almost these sort of satanic things that just came across the countryside, belching smoke and stuff. But then there was also the people who were saying, you know, trust the science. If you travel that fast, the air will get sucked out of your lungs and all this sort of thing.
Pregnant women will miscarry and the milk will go sour in the fields and all this. Yes, the science was pretty one-sided on that.
Yeah.
There's a genuine impact on the fabric of the country by this, though, because doesn't it make it easier for people to migrate. Essentially, it just makes it easier to get from one side of the country to the other side of the country. So I mean I happen to know, from, you know, knowing a bit about economic history of this period, that there's quite a lot of internal migration and urbanization, a movement people generally from rural areas into urban areas over this, you know, 50 year stretch of history. How much do the railways have to do with that? I mean, are they
They're basically the enabling technology. For all walks of life, suddenly you're able to move around the country in under 24 hours. And by 1850, you can go pretty much anywhere you want. And obviously, an awful lot of them went to London. But it was fascinating. You do read sort of the reactionary diehards at the time saying that we're going to tattoo, you know, this monstrosity across the face of England. And when it all goes bust, we're going to suddenly realise our folly and be left with all these mounds of industrial desiccation on the green and pleasant lands of England. They were genuinely scared what would happen when the pores suddenly started managing to move around the country. Because, of course, at exactly that moment, you get things like Peterloo and the beginnings of the Chartist movement. So you've got some very angry lower middle class artisans and workers who can suddenly go to meetings faster than the police can catch them.
See, what I find fascinating about this is that in a strange way, those diehard reactionaries did end up being proved correct in the very long run, because now, you know, most of England is like a kind of graveyard, you know, a set of ruins or monuments to that high point of industrialism, and they've never recovered since they've gone away. I mean, that's probably not the fault of the railways, but I'm just saying, like, in, you know, if you fast forward 150 years, maybe the reactionaries were in a strange way vindicated.
Yeah, in a roundabout way, they perhaps did have a point.
I'd probably blame the Attlee government more than I'd blame the railways for that, though.
Well,
yes, yeah. Nationalizing vast swathes of everything that wasn't nailed down, didn't really help. But the railways become a sort of weird point of pride, because actually they spend, it's very much like the empire in a way. We look back on it and assume that everybody was unanimously in favor of it. But particularly in the sort of 50s, 60s and 70s, the 1850s, 60s and 70s, the public opinion of railways isn't brilliant. And they don't do a lot to help themselves, actually, because they treat their passengers like dirt in a lot of cases. They just have utter contempt for them. They basically want to transport rich people and goods. And if you can't afford first class, that's because you're a dirty peasant getting the truck.
Yes, D would really have liked the early railways, because as Alex says, like, first class carriages were lovely. But then anything after that was essentially just a glorified truck with, if you were lucky, some seats. And it was just really, it was a bit grim. It was a bit grim.
So not to get too hyper nerdy here, but both of you fellas know a little bit about some of the technical details. What are some of the, during this period from, let's say, 1804 to, let's say, just say 1850, what are some of the big famous engines that come in on the lines that people might know about?
Well, I suppose if you sort of bounce between famous engines, you get Trevithick's Coalbrookdale engine. There's also the Penny Darren one, which is, there's a replica at Ironbridge and there's a replica of the other one at the Swansea Museum. Is it the National Museum of Wales? Which I've seen both of them. Then you go to locomotion number one on the Stockton and Darlington, which to all intents and purposes apparently was rubbish. It was a really bad engine. It was rebuilt about four times. Then you get Stevenson's Rocket.
Hold on a second. Let me just share a picture of locomotion number one.
Locomotion number one.
Is it this thing
it's
here?
It's that. Yeah.
Yes. That's the one, the replica at Beamish. Yeah.
It's a bit Percy-like. It's a very small little engine, isn't it?
Well, they were all very small back then.
Okay. And it's got four wheels.
Yeah.
0-0-4-0.
040, but yeah.
040, yeah, there we go. So I'm learning.
He's learning, right, so folks.
What's another one? That's locomotion number one.
Then you go for Stevenson's Rocket.
So the thing about Rocket, just whilst you're looking that up, the really important thing about Rocket and the reason why it's so celebrated in a lot of ways is because with a few exceptions, pretty much every steam locomotive after that point can trace its ancestry back to Rocket. Like, Rocket kind of laid out what steam locomotives would be like after that point. I mean, you might not think it from looking at it, but in real terms, a 9F that was built in 1960, the last class ever built for the national network, is a direct descendant of what we're looking at here. Yeah. Over 100 years earlier.
Is it 022?
Perfect. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's three big technologies in Rocket. One is a water jacket firebox. That's the little, I'm pointing at the screen, that's nice, is the little black box behind the barrel. Is over the top of that, there's a 2-inch jacket of water, which draws the heat out much more efficiently. Then going through the barrel is a multi-tube barrel. So there's lots and lots of little tubes to put the heat into the water, as opposed to on locomotion, where it's one enormous one, which gives you a far greater heating surface. And the next thing is the direct coupling between the cylinders and the wheels. So on locomotion, you add all, they actually call it the knitting, which is the gubbins on top of the barrel to work the wheels. These, they just connected them straight up. And if there was a fourth one, actually, I suppose it would be reliability. A lot of early engines either broke down or exploded fairly regularly. And Rocket was the first one that proved that you could run regular high-speed, long-distance services.
What's the idea of the very tall funnel in the front there?
It's drafting. So a big column of warm air like that will pull the fire.
Right. And it's, but they get much shorter over time. So was there some reason that they get, you know, this is very long, but if you fast forward a few years to the sorts of engines that the Thomas the Tank ones are built on, none of them have long, long funnels like that. They're all little stubby ones.
Really?
That's because the boilers got bigger and there's limitations of the loading gauge, which we will get into, I'm sure, at some point.
Yeah. All British engines to go under tunnels and things are limited to 13 feet high. So obviously when the barrel's only 4 feet across. Proportionally, the chimney looks really tall, but the top of the rocket's chimney is probably a few inches lower than a 9F. Might not be on that one. That looks a bit 15 foot or so. But yes, it's just the engine gets bigger and there's less and less room for a chimney.
I was just wondering, AA, if you could, on Google Image Searches, because I was going to bring up then sort of the next locomotive, really, if you could type in something like Lion steam locomotive, because this is a good example, vaguely, of how quickly things were developing and improving.
Lion.
Yeah.
Also known as the Titfield Thunderbolt.
Yeah, that was from the film The Titfield Thunderbolt, which I'm sure you've seen, being a man of culture.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, please, sir.
That's the deepest lore in itself. That is.
So this is a Lion. So what year was this from? This Lion.
So Rocket was built in 1829, and Lion was built in 1838. So you can see a massive development in the space of less than 10 years, really. I mean, huge amount of development.
I mean, this is a lot closer to the steam trains that everybody would think of, isn't it? You know, I mean, I guess that funnel is still quite long, I guess, but it still looks a lot closer. Also, 042.
Hey!
okay, so what was the upgrade from, like, what could this do that the old Stevenson rocket couldn't do?
Well, first of all, I mean, Alex is probably more au fait with the technical side of things, but the first thing that springs to mind, pun not intended, is that this actually has suspension. That's what you see, those things just sort of in front of the wheels, like the U-shaped things above the running plate. That's basically a form of suspension to give it a smoother ride and prevent derailments and whatnot. So that's a pretty big improvement in and of itself.
Yeah. You might also notice that the cylinders have disappeared.
Yes.
They've actually gone inside. And because on early railways, they were obsessed with centres of gravity, and they convinced themselves that if you built a tall engine, it would fall over. So the cylinders are actually really, really low down. You can just see the corners of them under the smoke box right at the front. And they actually pitch upward because you've got to have the cylinders pointing at the back back driving axle. So they've gone down there, which keeps them nice and toasty warm as they're together and not really in the wind. Another thing that Lion's got, which Rocket doesn't, is the beginnings of a proper reverser. Where on the very early engines, and Rocket's got this, you've got two levers that move with the valve gear, and they're a bit hypnotic. But in order to reverse the engine, you've actually got to disengage the eccentrics that runs off, and then physically move the valves back into where they should be. Hope you got it right. Put the steam in and then re-engage the valve gear, and then it will work automatically. Lion's got what's called GAB valve gear, which is an early form of reversing gear, where it's got two eccentrics, one forward and one backwards, and they both run little Vs. And one's the forward one and one's the backward one. And all the reversing lever does is just move them up and down, and they locate on a pin, which then runs the valve. So instead of fiddling about with these two handles on Lion, you've just got a big lever and you put it forward if you want to go forward and backwards if you want to go backwards.
Now, if I was playing something like Sid Meier's Railroad Tycoon and this new tech came in, I'd probably want to upgrade my trains and get rid of the old Stevenson rockets and put these in. But in reality, you know, what was the impact of this coming in? Like, did all of the rail lines get rid of their Stevensons and bring this in, or would you still have Stevenson rockets knocking around in, like, I don't know, 1840 or something?
No, Rocket herself only lasted 18 months. She was
So they just became obsolete technology, and they decommissioned them. Did they, or?
Yeah, absolutely. Like motor cars, like laptops, like phones. The first bit of commercial development was extremely fast. And you'll see that railways go through about three or four generations of engines in the first decade. And it's really after about 1850, 1860, where the technology becomes established and it starts to settle down. Yeah. But yeah, because Rocket's replaced by Northumbrian in 1830, which is then replaced by Planet in 1831, which is then replaced by Patentee in 32. Then you get engines like Lion coming through from about 1835. And every single one, they'll either sell them on to an establishing railway company or a contractor, or they'll just scrap them, which is why there's so few.
Interesting. What would the next one on be? What's after Lion?
Ooh, actually, you could do that one. If you type in LNWR Cornwall.
Okay. This. Yeah. Okay. I'll just share the picture. Here we are, LNWR Cornwall. So what's this looks significantly different in terms of its exterior. What's going on here then?
Essentially, it's mechanically it's almost identical to Lion. It's still got three axles, but instead of coupling the first two, it's only driving the center one. And they very quickly become obsessed with speed. And instead of making the engine go around faster, they just keep making the wheels bigger.
Yeah, that's a very big wheel there.
I think they had this weird obsession with making just the big single wheelers for a while. It's just this weird phase in development of express passenger locomotives where they just put a massive wheel on.
I think they're 8 foot and 1 inch. I think, was it seven foot nine, something like that. They're vast.
I can't really tell because of the angle of the picture, but is this is this 220 or 222?
It's a 222. You can just see under the cab, there's the oil box for the back axle.
Right.
Because when you start building an engine that big, with wheels that cartoonishly large, you end up having space issues. Of where to put the chassis, and the chassis is actually on both sides of the driving wheels, which then means you can run the axle boxes for the front and back axles on that side. But this one's got quite a cute story actually. So this was designed by Francis Trevithick, who was Richard Trevithick's son, and he worked for the London Northwestern Railway out of Crewe Works. And this engine survived up into the 1880s in regular service. It was actually rebuilt twice. If you see a picture of it when it was first built, it's bonkers because he tries to put the boiler barrel under the driving wheels. And it's a 422 with a weird double barrel boiler and it never works. So they rebuilt it like that. And then it actually went into retirement hauling the director's train for the London Northwestern Railway and then the LMS until about 1928, I think, by which point they went, even that engine's old even by our standards, so we'll stick it in the museum.
Now, you said 1928. Were they still running these? LNWR Cornwall, because you said the Stevenson Rocket had an innings of about 18 months. This one just kept on going, did it?
Yeah.
Just this particular one.
That particular one, yeah.
Not the entire class. That just this particular one before there's any, in case there's any confusion there.
Why though?
Because all railway men are basically traditionalists and somewhat reactionary and they don't like change, and so they like to have the nostalgia of having the odd antique arounds just for nostalgic purposes.
Now, what could this do with its very big central wheel that a lion couldn't do?
Go fast.
60 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Right, it could go faster. And, I should have been asking. All right, so we had the Rocket, we had the Lion, and we had this one. Now, I have been conditioned to know tender engines don't shunt, right? how much shunting did these do versus carrying passengers and mail and cargo, etc.? Like, what were they used for, these trains?
This particular one is a pure express locomotive.
This is a Gordon.
This is basically the Gordon of its day. If you go back on image search and type in, this is going to sound a bit odd, but type in something called old copper knob. It's not lewd, I assure you.
Old copper knob, right.
Well, thank God those are the results.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so this old is copper knob. Right?
This is an old Furness railway locomotive. It was built at a similar time to the one we were looking at before, but that this one here is more of a pure freight locomotive. And this would have done shunting, no doubt.
This is more of like your Oliver type.
This is more unlike your Donald and Douglas, really.
Sorry, that's what I meant. Donald and Douglas, yeah.
Donald and Douglas. Yeah. Locomotives like that, 060 tender engines, replaced locomotives like this, ultimately. Just your freight and do a bit of shunting and all that jazz. But you can already see it's starting, much with like the previous one, it's starting to resemble more of what we know as a classic steam locomotive, especially in terms of the front of the smoke box there.
And what about the Lion and the Stevenson? What did they do, like, in terms of their jobs?
Rather wonderfully, Lion is referred to as a luggage engine. And luggage in the very early days was freight. But they hadn't actually invented the difference between express passenger and freight services. So what they wanted out of Lion was a sort of medium speed engine that could pull a fairly useful load. So that was really what it was for. And they didn't have classifications of services necessarily, because basically everything went everywhere at 30 miles an hour with no brakes. So that was what it was. The train weights got bigger, and then they started sending off, they needed for more power and more driven axles, so you can get the power down onto the rails. Mm. And that's where Lion comes in. And that's the very, very beginnings of the split, because after Lion, and as you see into Cornwall, the main factor of the passenger railways is your ability to get somewhere fast, and the main bit of the freight engines is to try and pull as much as you can.
Right, so you could go at a slower, steadier speed, but you need more kind of power. So it's like almost like a kind of how can I, you know, when you're trying to go up a hill in your car and it's like you want to be in second gear type thing, bit like that, I suppose.
Absolutely.
So what's the next one after Cornwall? Would you, if you had to pick a kind of evolution?
Can I, as the self-declared Western man, bring in the first broad gauge engine?
Oh, are we going to go into the broad gauge diversion? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. We will.
Great Western Railway, or GWR Iron Duke.
That sounds cool.
Yep. Named after the man himself, of course.
Hold on.
Hold on. Yeah.
Is it this one?
No, the one to the left of that is probably the best one.
This one.
Yes.
It's a very small picture, sadly.
Oh, is it a small picture?
I can't. Not a historical photo, as you can tell by the Mondeo.
The one where it's just the engine and it hasn't got the tender.
This one?
Is that Wikidata? Yes. That's a reasonably large picture.
Okay, I can get that one up. Hold on. Here we are. The Iron Duke. That sounds cool.
Iron Duke. Now, that may not look like a particularly large engine until you realize that the wheels on that are 7 feet apart. So in 1835, Brunel and the directors of the Great Western Railway Company, as they then called themselves, because they hadn't built anything, got an act through Parliament to build a railway between London and Bristol, which actually I think at the time is the longest proposed line in the country. I think it's slightly longer than the London-Birmingham line.
Yeah.
And cleverly, they do not declare in the body of the text to what gauge the railways are going to be laid. Up to then, they've been laid at 4 feet, 8.5, with a couple of exceptions, which was just happened to be what Stevenson was laying all his coal cart railways back to the 1810s in. And that was rapidly becoming the standard. Brunel, because he is a man of iron will, simply declares that to be wrong. And therefore you should use 7 foot, and it will be much faster and much easier and much safer. And promptly does so. And these were the, technically I suppose you could say, the third generation express engines on the line. These are built, Iron Duke itself, I think the original is built in about 1847. it as a slightly enlarged version of the Firefly class. But they are so enormous and powerful, they basically go to the end of the broad gauge in 1892.
Now, Timestead, you mentioned the broad, was it Broadway or broad gauge diversion? That sounds like a kind of obscure thriller novel written by, like, I don't know, John Grisham or something.
Basically, the GWR was the GWR, and they liked to do things their own way, and they just thought, believe they were always better. And when it came to broad gauge, it's possibly true that, you know, well, almost objectively, that they were correct and that it was the superior system. But because everyone else was using standard gauge, the one that, you know, Stevenson's gauge, etc., the one that had been there from the beginning, more or less, and everyone else has standardized on that, the GWR were essentially forced to back down. And in a weird way, the GWR sort of cooked to the rest of the railway network and agreed to go back to using standard gauge, even though they knew broad gauge was probably better. But they, you know, the elitists were almost beaten down by by everyone else in a weird way. It's quite an interesting story.
The Great Western Railway referred to themselves as standard gauge and everybody else as cart gauge, rather dismissively. And yeah, the gauge on commission, the Commission on Gauges, which is the late 1840s, declares in its findings that although broad gauge is in every way superior because more standard gauge has been laid, that's what we're going to go with. And therefore, unless you're building a specific narrow gauge, like 2 foot or something, you have to build it to the standard 4 foot 8.5. And any lines that the Western builds, if it links up with a narrower gauge, it has to lay a third rail to allow narrow engines to use their right of way.
So an early bit of a regulation there.
As EMB said in the chat, the GWR had this transitional period where they had sections of the line that were both broad gauge and standard gauge, and the track work and the point work for those is absolutely insane. Like, they had this, it must have gotten to the point where the need for interconnectivity with other railways became so expensive and such a financial burden, having to maintain these incredibly complex tracks that could essentially run both, that they just threw their hands up and said, fine, we'll go over to standard gauge. And supposedly, legend has it that they converted their entire network. Was it overnight? They converted it?
It wasn't quite overnight. It was over a long weekend, though, which is amazingly impressive. Yes, that was it? The May bank holiday weekend in 1892. And they did the whole main line from Penzance up through Devon all the way back to Paddington. They re-gauged it over the weekend. So the last train left Friday evening as a broad gauge train, and then a narrow gauge train left Paddington Monday morning.
What happened to all the broad gauge engines? They just scrapped them, did they?
Scrapped. Gone.
Some of them were built with the idea that you could change them over to standard gauge, because the GWR had almost seen this coming. But most of them were scrapped, as Alex said.
There were two survivors. There's one called Tiny, who is the only... engine to survive, original broad gauge engine to survive, and that is in the South Devon Railway Museum, because that was the shunter at, I want to say it was like on the Exeter Canal or something like that. I'm sure the chat will correct me, but I haven't got it up at the moment. And the other one was another Iron Duke class called Lord of the Isles, which stood for years in the Crystal Palace, but then, of course, was lost when that burned down in 1931.
Now, just a couple of questions on the Iron Duke before we move on. Now, this is another Gordon, is it? This would have done like express.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
This was a passenger train. Why? I noticed this is 4-2-2. What's the idea of having the four wheels in the front and the two at the back? Like, what's the point of these different configurations of the wheels that we're looking at? Anyone know?
Well, yeah, actually, that's to fix a design flaw. Originally, the Firefly class, which you can bring a picture of, actually, because the Didcot Railway Centre built a replica of it, They started off with a 2-2-2.
Firefly.
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 You might want to put Firefly steam locomotive in.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'll get actual Fireflies on the TV series.
Or that song from 2011.
Or
looking at this.
Yes. So you can see that's been built as another 2-2-2. The problem was is that as engines got bigger and there was more and more weight over the front axle, due to the interesting quality standards of the time, they suffered a number of front axle breakages where there's simply the cylinder block's too heavy, there's too much power going through it, and the oscillation on the rail wears out the axle and it just falls apart. So the solution to that was simply to put another axle on to split the weight.
I occasionally see four wheels at the back, though. Presumably that's because of, I mean, why would they put two wheels at the back sometimes? I've seen that, like, where it's, I don't know, let's just say, like, 2-2-4. I've seen that on a few. Is it Henry who's like that on the top of the tank? I can't remember, but there's some trains that have more wheels at the back. Why would they have more wheels at the back?
Well, they're to carry the weight of the firebox, and they're also there for ride. Because if you've got a long boiler over a very short wheelbase, as the speed increases and you've got these two whacking great pistons going backwards and forwards, the engine starts to rock on the rails, which is bad for the wheels and bad for the rails. So if you put another axle at the back, it's just to check on that oscillation as it's going down the track. You can also put a much bigger firebox in, and the bigger the box, the more coal you can burn, therefore the more steam you can make.
Do you remember I don't know if you watched this episode in Thomas with Scarlowe, where he derails quite a few times, and then they put two trailing wheels at the back underneath his cab, and it stops the problems of derailment. It's there to distribute weight and help with ride qualities and that sort of thing.
Mm. Now, one question I've got for you guys now. We have reached the Iron Duke, and that went all the way until 1892. Is that right, or is there more developments in the late 19th century in terms of the next engine that we
the next sort of thing you want to go for? Not really, but it will set the scene for the next technical developments. If you look at late Victorian engines, if you go for something like, I'm trying to think of Dun Alastair or Midland Railway 2P. That would be a good one.
Yeah, I was going to suggest that, or like the compound. Although I was also going to suggest if you just go on, this is a good one because there'll be a lot of pictures of this. Go on Google image search.
That's a nice engine, though.
That's nice lovely. One. That's one of my favourites, actually.
Yeah, it is very nice. Yeah.
Looks a bit like Henry, by the way, but, you know.
It's a souped up Edward, actually.
Yeah.
Is it really? Oh, right.
So 440 basically replaced the big single wheelers, essentially, in terms of the primary express locomotives at the time. They sort of realised the big single wheel was perhaps not as good as they thought it was, and you end up with something like this. We've leaped quite a bit in terms of timeline here, but it is, you're looking at sort of late, your Victorian era, late 19th century type locomotive.
And this was a passenger train.
Yes.
And you can tell how much bigger those have got because that's got 6'9" driving wheels, and they don't look big. So they're enormous. They really come out. The Midland compounds are a fascinating engine because they come out of the constant battle within the railways themselves. And there's always this fascinating debate between the permanent way department, who look after the track and the bridges and the stations, the operating department, who timetable trains and offer services to the public, and the locomotive engineers, who are basically told to not break the railway by making the engines too heavy, and yet are told by the operating department to be able to operate really heavy trains at faster and faster schedules. And this really kicks off in the sort of 1890s, 1880, late 1880s, 1890s. Really for some really simple developments. One was the societal thing where suddenly shooting in Scotland becomes really popular. So suddenly you've got, because the royal family spend their summers up in Scotland blasting away at the local wildlife, the London bourgeois and elite want to do exactly the same thing and go up to their estates in the Highlands and blast away the, anything that moves. So there's suddenly a demand to get well-paid passengers an awfully long way, right up to the other end of the country. And so the railway companies start competing on price, and less so price, but actually more services on the train, because you're going to be on the train for between 9 and 12 hours. So you start getting things offered like restaurant cars and sleeper cars, and you want to make the coaches much more comfortable. And this comes about with the development of corridor stock, where before that, the coach was just a collection of boxes, and each one had its own door, which is why you see on commuter stock, even into the late 80s, there's so many doors down the side. Once they suddenly come up with this novel idea to put a corridor down the side of the car, you can suddenly start moving around the coach. But if you can move around, you can move around to go to the loo, or you can move around to go and buy a sandwich, or you can move around on some of the really luxurious trains. They had like drawing rooms. So you might wish to adjourn to the smoking room at the back of the end, back of the train.
One of the things I've always loved, and I don't know when the Orient Express comes about, right? But I love old movies where they spend significant amount of time on the train, right? The ones that spring to mind are that there's a cheesy old Hammer horror movie called it's called like The Horror Express. It's got like Christopher Lee knocking around on a train. It's a deathly boring film, but I love the I just love watching them knock around in the train. Or something like there's a Hitchcock movie where they spend loads of time on the train as well. Is it North by Northwest? I can't remember now. And then there's another one. Any film set on the Orient Express, of course. A couple of the Bond movies, the early ones, spend quite from a lot Russia of time on these. Yeah, from Russia with Love. There's loads of it is spent in a train. And I always think, like, those trains look amazing. The interiors of the carriages look like, you know, and I always had this dream of like going to Russia on a train, playing a long game of chess with a friend, you know, when we'd just be playing chess with, you know, changing backdrop. It never happened, of course. But
Can I just interject here? Because we're focusing far too much on flashy passenger locomotives, and we need to actually look at the real money in this. Because passenger traffic was mostly just there for PR. It didn't make a loss. It made them a modest profit, but freight was the real, real money earner. If you go back on image search,
hold on a second, the time still. I wanted to ask though. When did the likes of Orient Express and those kind of very prestigious sort of, you know, cross-continental trains come about? Is it quite a bit after this, or
no? It's almost at exactly the same moment, which is why you end up with engines like this. So, the Midland Railway actually are the first railway in the country to import Pullman cars from America in about the very end of the 1870s. Once you start having trains you actually want to be on, then you can start building these really long expresses. I think the Orient Express has been around since about 1898, and it really reaches its zenith in the Belle Epoque and just before World War One.
Yeah.
And I read an amazing statistic, actually, which was that in 1913 there were 1.2 million people went across the Channel for holidays or business or whatever. And that really is, that cross-channel traffic was huge business for people like the London to Chatham and Dover and the London and Brighton railways and people like that, and the London Southwestern Railway into Southampton, and then you'd go other places. So that's where that sort of comes from. And those great trains of state, as you almost want to call them, that are just laced in mahogany and gold and cocktails, that's really prior to World War One, because then after World War One, you start get the development of air travel. And then it's air travel, and yes, you might not be comfortable, but you can get across Europe in a couple of hours as opposed to a couple of days. Really starts to kill those off, unfortunately. And it's exactly the same in America, really, with the demise of passenger travel.
Just before I let you go on to the you know, the shunters and so on, time stealer. I just want to mention I like watching a show. You know, the Roald Dahl show, Tales of the Unexpected, may even be worth doing a whole Deepest Lore on it at some point. But that's in the 1970s. Mm. And one of the things I can't help but note when I watch that show is that it often follows, you know, the protagonist to work. And, you know, they're all at the train station. They all queue in the same place every day. You know, and they're just on their commute on the way to work. And then they go in and they have a whole carriage. They, you know, they read their newspaper. There's just six people in there. It's not crowded. You know, I thought, well, that's a world away from the sort of commutes I had to do into London, where you're literally pressed up against some sweaty Herbert's, you know, armpit or whatever. and I'm just, I just wonder about, like, how, you know, you mentioned there were carriages for peasantry and so on, but I imagine that there was more space on the trains. There was more, it didn't get crowded like that, where you were all like pressed up against each other, or did it? I don't know. Do we just have a kind of...
Back then it was a lot easier for them to just add more traffic, because you could just add more coaches. You could just put more coaches on, and you're done. You can't, because the way modern railways and rolling stock works, you can't really do that. Whereas back then it was a lot easier for them to be a bit more flexible with how many people they were carrying. Yeah.
But no, a lot of the commuter traffic into London was just as crowded as it ever was. Although rather wonderfully, in my book, I've actually got a book on the turbomotive, which was the LMS's sole steam turbine driven engine. And it tools, because it always did Euston to Liverpool. And on that train, there was about 15 coaches being pulled by the engine, because apparently it was bad manners on the part of the railway company if passengers didn't have a compartment to themselves. So you'd have a six-person compartment, and you'd have maybe one or two people in it. But amazingly as well, was they actually timetabled in the train to slow down whilst the soup course was being served in the first-class dining car.
I mean, we need to return to that. I think everybody should have a carriage to themselves. I think that's excellent.
Yeah.
Or one or two people per carriage. All right, Time Stealer, get to your shunting trucks then.
Now we're getting on to... Go on.
Down the Great Train of Being and start... We've done express. Do you want to go to like mixed traffic and then to freight and then to shunting?
Oh, what I was going to say to AA, because even by 1900, there was still quite a somewhat clear delineation between, you had express tender locomotives, freight tender locomotives, and then tank engines. And mixed traffic was, there were some mixed traffic ones, but like as time goes on, you notice that mixed traffic locomotives become more and more prominent. Mm. But what I was going to suggest was, if you go back on Google and type in, say, L and Y ironclad, L and then an and as in the the symbol and, yeah, there we go. No, that's not right. You need to type it.
Hang on. I might be able to find its actual class number. I've got all my books next to me. So.
Oh, L and Y class 25. That'll do. No. Oh, that one, no.
The one on the end is.
The one on the end is similar.
The one on the right is basically correct.
It's close enough. Yeah.
Filthy, disgusting engine.
Well, they were because they earned their living pulling freight trains and all coal and all sorts of stuff. And this is kind of your archetypal Victorian 060 tender engine. And this was the workhorse of the entire network, really. in a lot of, not this, engines like this, not this particular class necessarily, but.
Are you trying to stand up for the lower orders here?
It's because I'm Northern pilled and I have to, you know.
these are the working class heroes, and these are the engines who actually make the money. Yes. For the railways, and
I did calculate famously that Percy is responsible for about 60% of the entire economy of Sorador. So, you know.
Oh yeah.
So yeah.
These engines, actually, the first 060 tender engine is essentially they just take Lion and also couple up the last axle, and that's in about 1834, I think. And design wise, these are identical. And looking at the tender, that's a later BR crest. So yes. I bet that image is probably taken in about 1959 to 1963, something like that.
These were built by Lancashire and Yorkshire Railway, and they were quite advanced, it seems. And a lot of their 060 tender engines lasted long enough to get that second, the late era British Railways crest. I think the last one was withdrawn in 1962.
They were still knocking around in the 60s, these.
My personal favourite was the one that I was trying to get you to find and you failed at finding. There's a locomotive that's preserved at the Keighley and Worth Valley Railway, and that was built in about 1874, and it was withdrawn in about 1958, 56 maybe? Yeah, that one. There you go. Yeah. That is an absolute mad lad of an engine. Like they just somehow continued to carry on going for what would be 80 years.
I mean, that's a very classic choo-choo, isn't it?
That was as someone in chat pointed out, that was in the Railway Children, that particular one, because it just looks so archetypally Victorian.
But this mainly did shunting, you said.
Not shunting, it carried freight, because there would have been dedicated freight trains, so this thing might have just carried, pulled rather, you know, 40 coal wagons from a colliery to a coal depot, or you know, or something like that, or for a populated area, or that sort of thing. We'll get onto the shunting engines in a second, but that's what you're looking at here. Is there was tens of thousands of locomotives similar. Different designs, but similar all across the country. And that's what earned the money. Up until they carried on building locomotives like that, just bigger and more powerful, up until the 30s, because it was just a solid design. Solid.
So this was the engine room, the powerhouse of the British industry then, this train.
Yeah, for really two very simple reasons. Because you've connected all the wheels, all its weight is available for traction. They're not very big, so they can fit around most corners and things like that, and even get into factories sometimes. And the other thing is they're just bomb-proof. They're so simply built. You've got a wagon top firebox, so the boiler's just a tube. The cylinder block is one casting. You've got a standard set of valve gear that you just make in their thousands, and they bung those together in no time. And they just knocked out hundreds and hundreds of them. Mm-hmm. Even individual railways, you end up finding that they've built like 400 or 500 of them.
Couple of things just on the subject of these cargo trains. We've been talking about how the prestige passenger trains and the Orient Express and so on. Do you know if there was a differential in the pay? Like, because you said that these really brought in the money, so. Was the driver of one of these trains, or the little dude who worked in the firebox, hauling the coal or whatever? What do they call it? Shoveling the coal. There's a little dude who was in the engine room who shoveled the coal in. Is that right?
And then there's the fireman. The fireman.
Right. So. I mean, would those guys get like decent pay, given that they were bringing in quite a lot of money, or train driver get paid more?
You were not at the bottom. You were on the bottom rung of the top ladder of engineman, if that makes sense. So the reason the express guys got paid the most was because they were expected to have the engine absolutely on point, working at its absolute peak, not dropping any time, working to very tight schedules. So you've got to be absolutely on your game to drive an engine pulling 15 or 16 coaches at over a mile a minute. These little engines, particularly up north, and I'm sure you talk about the LNWR cauliflowers that ended up on the Cockermouth branch in Cumbria, they were rattling backwards and forwards at 15 miles an hour. And if anything came past them, then they'd be shoved in a shunting loop and you'd be stopped for hours. They just poodled around the network with no continuous braking system, making the revenue for the company. But as far as driving an engine goes, it's not the challenging job.
Right.
So also, there was some sort of rank within the actual drivers and firemen. I'm not sure when this was first introduced, but you basically had, you had firemen and you had drivers. But there was two ranks of firemen and two ranks of drivers. So you had a fireman, and then once you'd done that enough and you become experienced, you become a past fireman, which means that you're like a basically a more experienced fireman. And a past fireman would usually fire on an express or something that was important, but a past fireman could also drive was allowed to drive a steam locomotive. So a past fireman might be allowed to drive something like this. And then when you get up to drivers, you have drivers and past drivers. And then, so the express was always driven by a past driver. It's why when you look at like newsreel footage from Flying Scotsman and Mallard and stuff, the driver's often quite a mature gentleman because he's been around that long. It's usually a bloke in his 50s that's driving because they've been around for decades and they've driven for decades, and they can work the locomotive to its best, but they also can pull the train safely, which is important when you're traveling at high speed and pulling a lot of people around. And
there was also the simple managerial aspect of it, which was in order to drive, you had to have a rail card, which was a list of all the routes you knew. And you had to know every single signal, every signal box and who was in it, where they could put you in a shunting loop if you got into trouble or you had a breakdown or anything like that. And when you're pootling around a branch line in rural Devon, there's not that much to know. You're only going sort of 15 or 20 miles or something. Once you get up to Top Link, as they called it, which was the big international expresses, the Anglo-Scottish expresses, you've got to know every box and every signal for 400 miles. And you've got to know them all the way there and all the way back again.
And it was a very skilled job. Weird. It was a skilled job.
Probably they'd be paid like top dollar for that. They'd get more money than the other drivers because they were at the top of their game.
A past fireman did make the most. Not a past fireman, a past driver made the most. But I think they got paid extra essentially for unsociable hours as well and things like that and whatnot. But I don't think it would have been necessarily a huge amount of financial extra recompense. It was more the prestige. It was also a prestige and a sense of pride that you got to do that. You know, you didn't have to just do some shunting, some coal trucks in the yard. You got to pull, you know, one of the most prestigious workings in the entire country, in the most prestigious country on earth, essentially.
And of course, the most prestigious you could possibly do was either a royal train or a record breaker.
Yes.
Once you were the King Emperor, you were in.
Karen, Alex, sorry.
No. I was going to just, you really were sort of a working class hero. If you'd pulled either the King Emperor as he was, or a record breaker, that was it. You were made. Although I was always much more respecting of the firemen. I don't know if it's being a pyromaniac or something, but you have to be into steam engines. But the fireman had by far the worst job. On a big Anglo-Scots Express, you'd be going for 8 3/4 hours and you'd shovel maybe 6 or 7 tons of coal. God. And particularly the Eastern Main Line, which is the LNER, which goes up through Lincolnshire, up through York, Newcastle, and then round, is fairly flat and fairly straight. But the West Coast Main Line, which goes Birmingham up between Liverpool and Manchester and then up over the Pennines and the Scottish Lowlands, there's some big hills in that. Famously, there's Tea Bay and Shap, which sends, yeah, boy. Sends a shiver up the spine of any railway enthusiast, because by the time you get to Chap, which is about 6 miles of 1 in 75, where you are demanding the absolute peak performance out of the engine, you've been shoveling for about 6 hours, and you've maybe shifted 3 or 4, maybe 4.5 tons already. And then you get to these hills and it is an hour of solid shoveling. And it's like a 30-40 pound shovel, and you just keep going and going and going. And every single shovelful has to be put in the correct place, because otherwise it won't burn properly. And you've got to keep the water in the boiler, because that's your responsibility. And it was not only a test of engines to get over there, but it was a test of the guy firing, because you are the fuel pump. And if you fail, the engine stops, and you are a long way from civilization up there. So if you were a past fireman on an Anglo-Scottish Express, you were amazing.
Being a fireman was more of a young man's job. And then, you know, eventually, if we were past fireman, you would get up to driver. I double checked because I was curious how old he was. Joe Duddington, who was the driver of Mallard when it broke the world steam speed record, which it still holds, he was 61 when he drove that, which is a bit mad considering that record still held. He's traveling at, what was it, 123 miles an hour?
126, yeah.
126. And he's driving this, you know, absolute monstrosity, but that's because he was the best man for the job. Because he'd just been doing it for about 40 years of his life, probably, around trains.
He apparently, they have that amazing phrase of, he had a reputation for driving engines hard. And when you're trying to get it 30, 40 miles an hour over its design speed, yes, you need to drive an engine hard.
So can we carry on moving down the great chain,
one more thing, because there has been some people in the chat, including Alex, and I was going to mention this as well, asking that we bring up the terriers. So I was going to use this as the example of the archetypal Victorian tank engine. So if you go on back on image search and type in terrier steam locomotive, and there'll be a bajillion results, because these are very popular.
There's about 11 preserved, isn't there, I think?
Yeah, because they lasted. Once again, this was a very long-lived class. You find tank engines quite often last longer than tender engines, because you don't really need to innovate as much with a tank engine. They basically stay the same.
I believe I used this for the front cover of the...
No, the front cover was a Ginty. That comes a bit later.
Oh,
that's you should be. These were just... very long-lived locomotives, and so you see the specialism in tank engines become more prominent and more diverse, actually, in terms of their design as time goes on, and this is what does the shunting mostly a locomotive like this. Interestingly, this particular class is very, very popular. As Alex said, there's 11 of them preserved. Stepney in Thomas and Friends was a terrier, based on a real one. And a bit of YouTube deep lore. Do you remember a YouTuber called Drillaster or Drillastra AA?
Vaguely, yeah.
Yeah, she had a terrier as her avatar. She was really into trains. That's a bit of really random deep lore for you there about YouTube. But yeah, this is... The one behind it is actually an industrial one called Bellerophon, which I'm also very fond of. But yeah,
the terriers actually sort of fall from grace and find their little niche. They're built in the 1870s as suburban tank engines, so they're built to pull cartloads of commuters into London from the home counties. Then, when the size of the trains gets bigger and bigger, these are simply overwhelmed and they have to build bigger tank engines. They then end up finding their niche on the Hailing Island branch, which is an island to the right of Portsmouth on that spit. But across the waterway, there's a wooden viaduct, which, because railways are tight, they never actually improved. They never put a steel one in. And the wooden viaduct had a very, very low weight tolerance. And these were found to be the only engines that could actually pull little commuter services out of Portsmouth, across this viaduct, and then onto Hailing Island. And they stayed there until 1965. So by the time some of them got scrapped or preserved, they were 90 plus years old. And they're still going around today.
That still happens quite a lot. The BT well tanks had a similar experience where they were just... A particular class of locomotive would just carry on for getting on for 100 years because the railway, it was cheaper to just keep them working than actually improve the infrastructure on a line. So they'd just keep on overhauling them over and over and over again.
Are there two of them in this picture here?
Yes.
Yeah. But they're not the same.
No, yeah. They're completely different class. The front one's a terrier. The front and the one at the back is a type used on a colliery. Or is it? No, it's Haydock Colliery in my part of the world, I believe, actually. And that's called Bellerophon. That was my grandmother's favourite locomotive, incidentally, that one, the second one there, weirdly.
All right, so...
That is a tank engine, but it's called a well tank because the tank is actually between the frames, so you can't see it.
Quite rare.
What's next? Can we move down? I want to see some of the real skanks now.
If you want to see the absolute degeneracy, look for the what would they call them? They're called the USA type.
We're skipping ahead a lot there.
You're skipping ahead quite a lot. If you want to go to the bottom of the God's great chain of being when it comes to railway engines,
what a filth.
So these are built by the American Locomotive Company for the U.S. Army Transportation Corps during the war.
World War II, that is.
World War II, that is, yeah. And they are a typical American switcher, as they call it, because they can't actually even call it right, with outside valve gear, outside cylinders, big cab, which the Americans are obsessed with, lots and lots of domes for no adequate reason. But they have an extremely short wheelbase. The wheelbase on the real one is only 10 feet, which means they can get round very, very sharp curves. And after World War II, these are all knocking about. And the Southern Railway Company buys about 20 of them. And they end up in Southampton docks because the lines around dockyards are traditionally really, really wiggly. And they find that they can get round the corners perfectly well, and they pack a fair bit of power. So they shunt trucks up to and back from ships, and they also move around boat train coaching stock when it's not being used. Funnily enough, these actually worked alongside the Billington E2, which is the engine Thomas the Tank is based on.
Yep.
I mean, I like the idea, you know, since we did the Thomas stream time stealer, you know, the use of the phrase truck as an insult has taken off.
I know that, like, the truck is like beneath the midwit. You know, you get the truck and then you get the midwit and then you get the big brain people.
I like to imagine that, you know, we could also coin US, you're a real USA type as a insult as well.
Get it off the screen. I love, like, the really down at heel, like, sort of honest working man engines. You know, some of my favorite types are industrial or like emergency military types, but this is just pure hideous American trash.
Yeah.
It's funny, there's another crossover in the board game world. The Eurogamers look down on Ameritrash board games as well. Anyway,
interestingly, weird little interjection here. The image you had on the thumbnail, the Jinty, very sort of comparable to something like this. They were first built by the LMS just after the grouping. 060 side tank. They were originally going to use that as the standard British military shunter in World War II. But then it was basically too expensive and too complex, so they came up with one called, if you actually go on Google Images and type in austerity saddle tank.
Yeah.
And this is basically the British version of the Amerimut shunter.
But then you see it has a sort of nobility to it.
Yes. It has, this is like Anglo pride, like just, you know.
That looks a bit like Donald and Douglas, a little bit, because of that kind of.
Well, Bill and Ben are saddle tanks as well.
Bill and Ben. That's it. Yeah, Bill and Ben.
Bill and Ben. Yeah, they are similar in the. I suppose the archetypal industrial British shunter is a saddle tank, and this is like the archetypal saddle tank. They built about 1,000 of these between for the government and industry after the war and all sorts. They built untold hordes of them. And very reliable, very cheap, easy to maintain, fantastic bit of kit. I think it's the most numerous preserved steam locomotive by quite some distance, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I basically grew up around these, so I'm quite fond of them for that reason. Yeah, but this is the British version of what we're just looking at.
But it's still a Stevenson engine. It's exactly the same to the Lancashire and Yorkshire tender engine, and then all they've done is put a saddle tank on it, which was quite common actually for, particularly when we were talking about sort of the second and third gen engines, when they got a bit tired, it wasn't uncommon to actually convert them into tank engines. And if you go to sort of the 1920s, you can see video footage of these. They're just about still in service, you know, engines from the 1860s and 70s, where we had a medium sized mixed traffic engine, didn't need it anymore, so we bolted some tanks to it and a ludicrously tiny bunker on the back for like 600 weights of coal, which won't get you very far. But then it becomes a work shunter, or it becomes station pilot, or it becomes an industrial, and they survive forever. The austerities actually even more so, because they went not only to British Rail, but they went to people like the National Coal Board and power stations. And particularly at power stations where they were using the demineralized water that went through the power station boilers, they lasted forever. And some of them lasted into the 1990s. So they never went to the scrapyards. When the preservationists were looking around for engines, these were still in service, and they just bought them off the NCB.
That's why there's so many of them.
Mm.
Yeah, that's why they're so numerous, because they lasted the longest, basically.
All right, so let's move into the 20th century now. I mean, what would some of the next evolution, you know, we've been through a few generations. What was happening, let's say, in and around World War One? What were the sort of trains like then?
The two big developments, I would say, would be the little 060 tender engines we were looking at. For a lot of traffic, they were found not to be big enough. So a lot of railways started to move to 8-coupled goods locomotives, bigger. If you go on Google Image Search, type in, I suppose, let's go with the GWR 2800. For Alex, because he's a GWR man.
Actually, I was going to say, if you want a direct one, you go for London Northwestern Railway Super D, actually.
But I was going to say that, but I didn't want to be favouritist, because I love the Super
polite.
D. It's one of my favourites, the Super D. Yeah.
Apparently, it's a GWR
drop. One.
Yes.
Super
yeah.
D.
No,
but
this isn't the Super D.
No.
Super Mr. D train. Here we go.
Super Mr. D train.
I love these. I love them.
I think this is a good example of it. 080.
Yes. So when six wheels isn't enough, you bung another axle under it, and then it becomes enough.
And what did these do?
Coal trains.
Similar to the 060 tender engines, but just bigger and more, basically heavier. Yeah. Look, it's a bit of a unit like these. You just got to get bigger, and because of the loading gauge, because they couldn't really go higher, they just had to go longer. Really, you can't because of the size of tunnels. Basically, in this country, you can only make a locomotive so high, and so they had to make them longer. And so you end up with more wheels and big to support a longer boiler, which provides more power essentially. But this is one of my favourites.
Yeah, teeny wheels, because you don't have to go very fast. Loose coupled trains, as they were. For some bizarre reason, freight trains in this country were never braked properly. There was never a continuous braking system. So these would pull 1,000-ton trains of coal, and the only brakes would be on the engine, the tender and the guards van like half a mile back at the back of the train.
Yes. You don't need continuous brakes. It'll be fine.
No, that's it. You're doing under 15 miles an hour. You're fine.
Yeah, you're right.
But these are interesting engines to drive, so I've heard, because if you fill the boiler up to more than halfway in the water gauge, they prime, which is really bad. The injectors exhaust under the foot plates, so you can't tell if the injectors are working. And they've also got a weird valve gear called joy valve gear, which is impossible to set properly. So these engines, they don't get a nice even beat in the exhaust. You get two quiet chuffs and then two big ones until you notch it back up and then it evens out.
I mean, it must have been pretty good because they kept on using them over and over again for a long time. This particular class, they outlasted the class of locomotive that was designed to replace them. So they lived longer than their replacements, essentially, in use. Mm. So they're, pretty excellent bit of kit.
Is that the Austin 7s you're on about?
The Austin 7s, 7F, LMS 7F. Yeah, rubbish. Absolute rubbish.
So what about in the world of the prestige engines around this time, 1910s, 1920s, what would a big one be?
If I may go back to the Western region, the big one is the GWR Star class.
That's exactly what I was going to suggest as well. The GWR were kind of the leaders when it came to the passenger side of things, I would say. So, yeah, that's a good choice.
Is this stuck?
No.
No.
This is actually my favourite engine.
Let's have a look.
And I'm gutted that they're never going to put it back in steam. So, those 422 Express engines with the single set of driving wheels, well, they were running up to about 1910 on secondary services. But certainly on the Western, within 15 years, this is what replaces them. And these engines.
Is this 266?
460s.
Sorry, 4.6. What are they then?
That's a tender.
That's a
tender. Okay, so you cut it off there. All right. So, yes, 4.6.0. Nice.
Beautiful.
Fast.
Very
powerful. Fun. That's basically the improvement of the 4.4.0, really. You once again, much like with the heavy goods locomotives, they just had to make the boiler longer to get more power. And when you've got to do that, you've got to put more wheels on, really, ultimately. And ultimately, more wheels gives more tractive power as well. So that's useful. Someone in the chat was asking about mixed traffic, and I was going to bring this up because you see the rise of the mixed traffic locomotive, which, in a weird way, the mixed traffic locomotive was a bit of a sign of the Kali Yuga in a bizarre way. Because
James.
Exactly, like James. And I was going to suggest GWR Mogul would be a good example of the other one.
Yeah. Interestingly, when we briefly touched on the 2800s, that has exactly the same boiler as that Star class. It's the standard Swindon number one.
Yeah. GWR were very good at standardization, which not a bad thing.
Until they weren't, they decided to standardize boilers and then add 16 standard boilers, some of which were only on one class. So it's not much of a... I think you're getting all the models because I think Hornby's just done a retooling.
Yeah.
That's a real one.
That's a real one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll bring this up. Hold on. By the sounds of things, I may have to wrap up in a minute. Okay, so here we go. There is the mixed GWR Mogul mixed engine, right?
Yep.
What we're looking at here.
Very James Midwit.
260. Is that right?
Yes.
This is like this. I'm not entirely sure who really started the trend of mixed traffic, but this is a very, very good example of an early mixed traffic. And this was very ahead of its time. I mean, for when it came out, this would have looked quite modern. 260. Smaller boiler. Bell Pair firebox. Always good. You can do anything with this. You wouldn't pull expresses and you wouldn't pull super heavy freight, but you could pull, secondary passenger stuff. You can carry, they can go at a decent speed because they've got the pony truck at the front, so they're more stable, so they can carry fast freight, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, just very useful, bit of a jack of all trades type locomotive. Also quite light, so it can go over lighter, because as going back to what Alex was saying about the bridge going to Hailing Island, the infrastructure on Britain's railways, a lot of the bridges can't take a massive amount of weight. And so having smaller locomotives with smaller boilers that are still powerful is handy. And this kind of fits in that category, really.
There's Time Stealer, look, sneaking out the window. All right. Well, I unfortunately may have to go in a second. So we're going to have to cut it a bit short today. I don't know how much more steam train is, because we must be coming up to, you know, you said they stopped being made in the 1930s, right? The steam train. So
they stopped being made in, the last one was made in 1959 for the network. We've only gotten about halfway, to be honest, because I was also going to talk about the dieselization and how that was a big money sink.
Oh, yeah. If I think we haven't really mentioned BR at all.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned nationalisation or anything like that.
Or anything like that. So
we haven't even.
No, I've got
like a list of talking points that might.
So maybe, you know, we can do next month or something. We can do a part two on the impact of nationalisation and the decline of British Rail.
Decline, yes.
Decline and fall of British Rail.
We need to talk about something called the Railway Clearinghouse as well, because that's a very, very interesting libertarian leaning topic that we should touch on.
Yeah, we didn't get into the juicy stuff about George Hudson or anybody like that, so.
I'll just check to see if there was any. There was just one super chat in the entropy from Years saying number one looks like Percy with a periscope. yeah, it kind of did, with those long funnels. And then just having a look, seems like a lot of the super chatters aren't, steam engine pilled.
yeah, we definitely need to touch on like the express developments in the 20s and 30s with. Scotsman and Mallard and all that.
Yeah,
all
that and stuff. Actually, why grouping happened and what was the state of the railways after World War One? I know it was one of the things you wanted to talk about. We haven't, so
yeah.
So we will come back. We'll have to come back for a part two. We kind of expected that we'd have to do.
I suspected we would end up with going to part two anyway. Yeah,
yeah. So Meganisa Shan has said, the English railway across the Indian continent is notable. Thank heavens it gave us the Durrells, my family and other animals indeed.
And yeah, colonial railways is a gargantuan topic in itself, really.
The Darjeeling Railway, that's the one everyone likes.
And Jakanranda Plus says, I'm playing the Banner Saga right now. Might be another one for Morcar to check out. When it comes to that, I'm told Morcar tells me that he's planning to check out some more modern RPGs like Dragon Age Origin or Divinity or even Pillars of Eternity. Well, just because, you know, Morcar spent the past 20 years saying that Baldur's Gate 2 will never be surpassed, and
it will never be surpassed. He's right.
But I mean, in terms of what we do on Deepest Lore, we'll have to bring you guys back on for part two. I know Pharaoh's been off for a couple of weeks, so he'll be coming back in next week. Possibly I'll do another wrestling thing. So
also,
we'll see.
I'd just like to point out that I've been replaying Baldur's Gate, and I'm going to replay Baldur's Gate 2. So eventually we can pencil in the Baldur's Gate Deepest Lore if we're really scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's Baldur's Gate lore. We could talk about how much I love Edwin. I've just seen another last minute super chat come in. Henrik Lindberg says, been watching this while cooking my puff pie for tonight's Easter celebration. Choo-choo, happy Easter. When is Easter, by the way? Is it this weekend?
Yeah, it's Sunday.
Yeah.
It's Sunday, okay. I'm going
to bank holiday tomorrow.
Yeah, you're not allowed to eat meat tomorrow.
All right, folks. Well, thank you very much. It's been educational. We'll have to figure out another time for you guys to come back in a few weeks, because I do think maybe the kind of decline, nationalization, dieselization, and its impact on Britain is probably significant, because I know one of the talking points that Peter Hitchens likes to bring up is the way the beaching cuts basically just cut off, you know, huge regions of the UK from having any rail connection or anything really. So,
well, I think the net negative himself is wrong again, because he's in favour of renationalising, which is definitely not the answer. And
not the answer.
No, I wouldn't. Yeah. I might speak in defense of beaching as well, which is a really controversial topic.
I also am a little bit beaching pilled. we also need to talk about how when they renationalized everything, it was utterly terrible and very, very badly done and almost designed to fail from the start, really.
If you want some Ashes of Civilization content, go and look at BBC documentaries about BR between about 1988 and 91, and just look at how awful everything is.
Okay, well, I will do that, maybe I'll do a tie-in Ashes based around that. All right, well, thank you very much, folks.
Don't forget to subscribe to Time Stealer. I've got another video on the way that involves Shergar. I should add.
I put links to your Twitter, Alex, and to Time Stealer's YouTube. Yeah, anything you'd like to shill before we get out of here?
Yes, absolutely. I actually came on the pretext that I'm the chairman of something called the Roby Trust, which looks after a collection of stationary and road vehicles, actually, as opposed to railway engines. You can get into the politics between the two sides. So look us up and like us on Facebook to see what we're doing. But beyond that, just make sure you go and support your local railway, because they're steam railway, because they're really suffering at the moment. So when all this nonsense is over, make sure you go and give them lots of money and buy plenty of sandwiches.
Yeah, I'm just having a look. The Roby Trust, you guys do like steam fairs and things like that.
Yes, cancel that for the second year running now. So,
due to the pandemic, obviously.
Due to it usually occurring in the first week of June, we'll be out and about. Don't you worry.
I'm just having a look at the pictures of these steam fairs that you could. Is it Tavistock Steam Fair?
Mm.
You guys put this on?
Lovely.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You've got a steam lorry as well, haven't you? I like the old steam lorry.
Yes. It's a bit in bits at the moment. And obviously, if you live locally, you're more than welcome to come up and have a look at it. But it's, the boiler's out at the moment when we're putting in a fresh tube plate and firebox. So you get to see some engines in bits and really look at their anatomy.
Yeah, that Fred Dibner show I watched had, he was making one of these.
The centre one is the one he drove when he was down. I didn't actually live in the area at the time when the family moved here. I just went, I know Fred Dibner went there. It's a place and it definitely exists. And I found it out. And a couple of years later, I was made chairman. So, hence, I've got a beer in his honour, actually.
Fantastic. Okay, great. Well, thank you guys once again. I will just say I'm very close to finishing Foundations of Rhetoric now, but I will reiterate once again that if you're thinking of doing that, I would say that the writing and the logic courses are almost prerequisites. Otherwise, it's like learning the dark side without learning the light. You know, I feel like, you ever see that show, that film, the martial arts one, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon or something. I seem to remember the plot of that. The guy hasn't completed his training and he only knows like bits of dark side. I feel like you need to do all three parts of the trivium to have a fully rounded, if you just do the rhetoric, I fear the darkness that I'd be unleashing on the world. So try to do the other two before you do rhetoric. And that will be, when that is released, the Trivium will be available as a bundle package at a reduced price, and I will give a special to those people who already got the first two, I'll do like a special deal so you don't miss out on the saving that you'd make by getting all three. All right. Thank you very much, everyone. Now get out.